Hi, this is Mary, and welcome to my podcast, Mental State, where I dive into all things mental health and more. So today on my show, I am talking with Dr. Nicole Obarto Trainer, who focuses on integrative mental health at her practice, Native Clinics. Nicole has advanced skills in mindfulness interventions, heart math biofeedback, and functional approaches to depression and anxiety, encompassing nutrition, micronutrient therapy, and amino acid therapy. So I'm really excited to have Nicole on this podcast with me. So thanks for coming on, Nicole.
You're welcome.
And I'm really curious, with my background as a registered dietitian and somebody who has shifted into the mental health space, I was really excited to read about Nicole because not only is she a psychologist, but she also specializes in the gut brain connection. And her work comes from more of an integrative lens, which I think is really important in the work, right? So Nicole, I want to hear your explanation of the concept of the gut brain connection and how it influences mental health.
So I think it's important that the constant interplay, right, between the mind and the body. And we oftentimes think about the mind a little bit more abstract, right? But the brain, the abstract mind, are interacting, right, all the time. So it's important to understand that what's happening in the physical body, or specific for this conversation, what's happening within the gut microbiome, the gastrointestinal system, is having an influence on messages that are being received by the brain. And those messages then have an influence, biochemical reactions, availability of vital neurochemicals for balanced mood and overall functionality, right? So I do practice from a very integrative with a specific focus on functional medicine, as opposed to maybe Western medicine ways of thinking about health and well-being and thinking about mental health. Mm-hmm. So when I talk about the importance of gastrointestinal or the relationship between the gut and the brain, it's important to also consider that relationship is not happening in isolation or a vacuum, right? That relationship has influence then on other functional systems throughout the body. So we are always considering like the endocrine system and the adrenal system and the thyroid. So I think that it's important to always be considering how the whole body is functioning, not just like one functional aspect of it, but certainly not just sitting in a place of conceptualizing mental health or overall health from the lens of the presence or the absence of symptoms, right? We tend to get caught in that space in our traditional thinking where we're just assessing prevalence and frequency, duration of symptoms. And I think we need to really pivot from that way of conceptualizing health to understand that those symptoms are really just like, that's internal messaging system. I always say that's your innate health trying to get you to pay attention to something that we have to address or begin to become more curious about so that we can change and ultimately improve or heal.
I love that. One thing that you just talked about was the adrenal system. And something that comes up for me, just both in my professional work and also in my personal relationships, when I talk to people about they're feeling so stressed out that they either can't eat or they have some gut issues as a result of that. And so can you explain that?
I think a lot of the stress on the functional systems of our body comes from the chronic stress that we're digesting, if you will, right, in our day-to-day lives, right? Like the pace in which we're living, the chronic nature of striving and doing, the shortchanging on like fundamentals for health, right? Like good nutrition, whole foods, good sleep, rest, and time for rest and restoration. I feel like when we think about sort of taxation on like the adrenal system and the impact on appetite or its relationship to gastrointestinal symptomology, like we have to be able to have conversations about the role of chronic stress in our daily lives and the resulting inflammation. Because this really ties into all these food sensitivities that we have too, right? We talk about this increase in food sensitivities, especially when we're talking about gastrointestinal health. And we really need to be curious once again about the relationship between food sensitivities and inflammation and how our ways of modern living are just driving chronic stress, which is just driving the secretion of the stress hormone into our system, right? That then, again, our adrenal system has to contend with and all the other functional systems of our body have to try to contend with. But then our bodies and our brains are in a state of constant inflammation.
Yeah, and it just makes me think about how just even the nutrition profile of foods have shifted over the last 30, 40 years in terms of nutritional content and also the quality of the food. And just going back to that stress piece, why is it that we tend to turn to unhealthier foods when we're dealing with stress, which actually exacerbates the problem?
Yeah, I think for a lot of people, because when they're under chronic stress or they're in stress, like they shift into scarcity, right? Like scarcity, overall scarcity, but then scarcity of time, right? If I think about like my clients and what I might hear as pushback, if I suggest like certain nutritional interventions that they perceive to be time intensive, is just that there's a scarcity of time in which I'm functioning from, and the whole foods that you're recommending I'm eating, or even a specific dietary protocol that you might recommend related to gastrointestinal health, for example, is time intensive. It requires preparation. It requires intentionality. And I think that we get into that scarcity mindset, right? There's just not enough time for that. I can't do that. I need a workaround.
Yeah. And so when you were talking about like these other kind of health issues, IBS, Crohn's, gluten sensitivities, how does that relate to the mind-gut connection or the brain-gut connection, or do they?
Yeah. So when you talk about like IBS, whether it be IBS with constipation or IBS with diarrhea, there is a significant psychosomatic component to IBS, to both its onset, maintenance, and the treatment. We have to be acknowledging the role of oftentimes anxiety, stress, right? And the resulting consequences of that anxiety and stress and how it's felt within our gastrointestinal system. And then how essentially it undermines vital biochemical processes for neurochemicals that are essential for maintaining emotional well-being. So when I think about somebody who, I think about co-occurring anxiety and IBS, right? I think it's so important that we acknowledge that 90% of serotonin receptors are located in the gut.
Yeah.
So if the largest percentage of serogenic activity is happening in the gut, and we don't have efficiency in the gut, like the gut is compromised in some way, whether it's compromised because there's an imbalance of good bacteria to bad bacteria, whether there's a permeability issue between the gut wall and there's it's called leaky gut syndrome. Like it's a very, very common, almost as common now as IBS, leaky gut, where there's a permeability issue between the integrity of the gut wall. And so what is being secreted into the bloodstream and ultimately then arriving in the brain is once again kind of compromising overall health and well-being.
What is being secreted from leaky gut syndrome into the body that ends up in the brain?
It's different for every individual. So a lot of times it can be from toxins. Most of the time it's some type of environmental toxin, or in some cases it might be a food sensitivity that's unbeknownst to us, that we have so much of it now in our gastrointestinal system that it acts like a toxin. So it's not a toxin like that we would say, oh, this household cleaner contains this particular toxin. So I know that there's a possibility of that being in my gut, but it's that I have this food sensitivity And it's not being actively addressed. And so there's so much of this particular byproduct from this food in my body that it's acting like a toxin.
And then what does that do to the brain?
It's essentially throws off like our nervous system, right? So we have increased anxiety because we have more that fight or flight. So we have way more sympathetic activity than we're able to probably counter with parasympathetic engagement. Mm-hmm. So heightened levels of anxiety. It also compromises hippocampal activity. So when we think about the hippocampus and its role in learning and memory, it compromises hippocampal activity. There's been studies that shown that there's implications in functionality of mitochondria. We have increased free radicals. So it's essentially, depending upon like your individual presentation, it can have various implications neurologically.
And that makes so much sense when we talk about the development of children and how there are all these food deserts in these different communities. And how people kind of brush off about how disruptions in gut health can contribute to mental health disorders like anxiety, depression, possibly ADHD, right? And we're seeing this in children more. So, yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Like when we think about like the developing brain and we think about the relationship between the gastrointestinal system, food sensitivities that are acting toxic to the body, like that are now toxic to the body, and co-occurring disruptions in executive functioning, whether they be like subclinical disruptions that we wouldn't say is full-blown ADHD, but certainly disruptions that are disruptive, if you will, to a kiddo's life, emotion dysregulation. This is a huge one, right? Anger, tantrums, right? Difficulty with transitions, right? Symptoms that we see again on a continuum, like when we think about autism spectrum disorder, right? Like those main symptoms that we look for in diagnoses, they occur on a continuum of severity, but we can have those present in kiddos who are not diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder, but yet they're struggling in the same respect, right? They're struggling with transitions, flexibility, emotion dysregulation, heightened arousal, sensory integration issues that are pretty classic in spectrum disorder or even show up in kids with attention deficit disorder. So I feel like we're to the point with our evidence in this area that it should almost be a given for any parent whose child is demonstrating weaknesses in executive functioning, characteristics behaviorally or emotionally that you might associate some like with autism spectrum style disorders, to simultaneously be curious about what am I feeding my child? What is my child's diet made of, up of, and like, what changes can we start to make here dietarily to try to improve the efficiency of the gut, the integrity of the gut, and see how that affects some of these symptoms that we're seeing.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Just thinking about how we treat our gut throughout these developmental stages can really prime our brains, or I should say our nervous systems, to be behaving a certain way, having this rigidity. Yeah, so that's so interesting. And then it's like the more you feed the beast, right, the more that these behaviors will manifest. And that some people, based on probably genetics or epigenetics, are more susceptible to these kinds of behavioral changes maybe than other kids. Or I should say that other kids are more susceptible. And I think it's also just when we bring this sort of nature versus nurture, when I'm talking about these food deserts, what is the nurturing that's going on around these food deserts, as opposed to maybe some kid who has more opportunities and maybe eating similarly, but was growing up in a different environment. So I just think that's interesting. And I think such an important segment of the population to be studied, especially when it comes to this brain gut mind body connection. So I want to bring it back now about diet, stress, sleep, and how that impacts that gut-brain access and mental health outcomes. I know that one thing that's going, one topic that is a pretty hot topic and has been for the last few years is about sleep, right? Are we getting enough sleep? Now, all of a sudden, we need to be getting 7 to 8 hours of sleep. People are wearing Aura rings or their Apple watches to track their sleep. How much time are they spending in the REM cycle and all of that? And so I'm just curious, have you found that sleep also affects gut health? Or maybe it's lack of sleep in terms of maybe people who don't sleep as much might have poor dietary choices.
Yeah, that's interesting to consider, like the influence, the relationship maybe between sleep and nutritional choices. I think that most of us would admit that when we're not sleeping well or when we're not prioritizing sleep, that it has a negative effect on both like the nutrition that we take in, the physical movement that we give ourselves, like make time and space for, the content that we take in, right? Like that it's a, I really do think it's about trying to find balance, right? Acknowledging each of the dimensions of like our humanness, right? And really working in all of them, working in nutrition and sleep and movement and spirituality or purpose and intentionality, right? Whatever you feel like speaks to you, and interpersonally, relationally, right? What are we doing to maintain a certain amount of investment in each of those areas of our life, right? So I don't even know if there's probably a direct relationship between sleep and gastrointestinal health, but more so that the lack of attention paid to sleep ultimately probably influences the choices we make with regard to attending to our, like our emotions and our feelings and processing them in an effective way, or engaging routinely or intermittently throughout the day in a contemplative practice that allows us to engage and build a relationship to the parasympathetic nervous system. Again, food preparation, right? Do I wake up rested? And so I feel like I don't want to hit the snooze button 4 times. So now I'm able to prep a lunch that I feel like is foods that I know are good for my system, or am I just grabbing something on the go because I'm tired? I stayed up too late scrolling on my phone. And then now I'm hitting the snooze button. Now all intentionality for the day goes out the window. So I know from the research that sleep is important, period, for like cellular restoration, yeah. Mm-hmm. And overall restoration. So it makes sense that sleep would be related to our gastrointestinal health, and that it's prioritizing a good night's sleep and rest is going to have a positive impact on gastrointestinal health.
Yeah. And then I just also want to go back to the serotonin, because I mean, that's a big thing too about, so you were saying 90% of serotonin receptors are located in the gut.
Yes.
Is there a difference between the serotonin receptors in the brain and the serotonin receptors in the gut?
No.
Okay. So the serotonin receptors in the gut are also ones that affect our mood.
Yes. So it's like serogenic activity, right? So essentially, in order to make serotonin, you need certain micronutrients and certain amino acids, and you need almost like a chemistry experiment to occur in order to create serotonin. So if you're, again, if you have compromised functionality within your gut, you would be hard pressed maybe to convert effectively the amino acid of tryptophan, for example, 5-HTP, in order to move it along in that biochemical process in order for it to be effectively converted into serotonin. And we know you need activated folic acid in the form of L-methylfolate, and we need B vitamins. So we need, again, it's like the proverbial chemistry experiment where you need to be adding these various micronutrients alongside these amino acids in order to create serotonin. And serotonin then carried through the bloodstream into the brain. So what our serotonin selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors are trying to do is they're trying to prevent like the uptake. They're trying to keep more of that serotonin available in the brain. So to prevent the uptake in the carried away of serotonin so that we have more access to it so that it can ultimately have an impact on how we feel.
So things like leaky gut, IBS, Crohn's can really affect how the serotonin is produced in the gut.
Yes.
Wow.
The transportation then of the right?
Can affect the transportation of the serotonin.
Yeah, both the production and the transportation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's pretty.
So then that ultimately availability of serotonin for the brain.
I don't want to speak generally, but I feel like there's so much separation between you're on an SSRI and you have IBS, leaky gut, and Crohn's. I sometimes feel like they're treated as two separate things. And so I love that. So in terms of your work and how you're more integrative, how would you work with a client who is on SSRIs and also experiencing all these gut issues and they're not really... They're in their head, it's two different things. They're not putting the two and two together. And so how do you create that more integrative space in your practice for your clients?
You're absolutely right that we were conditioned and through our healthcare interactions, conditioned to see the two as separate. Like I have IBS or I have some type of gastrointestinal disorder and I have this collection of symptoms that's not necessarily being keyed in as having a relationship to the IBS. It's being seen as separate, right?
Right.
So we depression and anxiety, and really we use those terms now very much interchangeably. I don't know if that's a byproduct of having to use SSRIs off-label to treat anxiety because mm-hmm. we had to move away from using benzodiazepines to treat anxiety. Yeah. Now we're just using, like we use depression and anxiety really are two very different clinical presentations for a patient. But so anyway, but we're treating depression and anxiety or however that's showing up with this SSRI. And then we're treating the IBS depending upon the course of treatment. It might be with a pharmaceutical or it might be with a specific diet. So a lot of times the FODMAP diet is used. You're probably very familiar with that in your right for treating gastrointestinal or IBS. But we're never really taught that we have to consider the interplay between the mental health symptoms and the physical body.
Yeah.
And certainly not ever taught that like a lot of that, the lion's share of the serotonin that we're trying to like jumpstart or make more available to the brain with the SSRI is actually like it's been compromised by the fact that our gastrointestinal system is inefficient, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's inefficient at basically making use of the micronutrients in the foods that we're eating. I think that's another like piece of the conversation is that sometimes I will have clients who are eating a very good diet, right? But they're totally missing the fact that there's inefficiency at the level of the gut. There's an imbalance. There's either a dysbiosis or an imbalance is another way of saying like an imbalance between good and bad bacteria in order to make the gut efficient. So they're not really getting the micronutrients from the whole foods that they may be eating. But again, I just think back to your point, we need to be talking about them as if we're trying to improve them simultaneously, right? Like that as we make improvements within the gastrointestinal system, as we soothe the nervous system, the very sophisticated nervous system in the gastrointestinal system that ultimately is inflamed because of the chronic stress that your lifestyle is bestowing upon it, as we soothe that, and we simultaneously address your relationship to your thoughts about what's going on within your gastrointestinal system and your responses, like more importantly, the responses you have to the initial onset of maybe pain or discomfort within the gastrointestinal system, right? So then we're just, there's this interplay back and forth between addressing the nervous system in the gut, its response to the inflammation that it's having to endure, and then our subsequent cognitive way of thinking up or taking up the IBS pain and then responding to that. So as we respond differently, we can maintain our gains with regard to our ability to soothe that nervous system, and it becomes less reactive. And then it just all starts to cascade then in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also what you're saying, working with the nervous system and perhaps integrating some somatic exercises in order to help soothe our nervous system, really. And so it's just a very multifaceted approach to helping people improve their gut health. Now, you were talking about good bacteria versus bad bacteria. And so what role do probiotics and prebiotics play in promoting a healthy gut microbiome?
So prebiotics are really just the foods that we eat that have the necessary micronutrients, fiber, right? They have the necessary nutritional components to improve the efficiency of the gut and to create the diversity that we need within the gut microbiome, right? And the probiotics are the more proactive bacteria that we're introducing to the gut in order to get that eclectic balance, right, of good and quote unquote good and bad bacteria, mm-hmm. right? The prebiotics are really, we really should strive to get prebiotics from the foods that we eat. We are often marketed supplements as prebiotics, mm-hmm. and it's not, I mean, they're supplements, right? But prebiotics are really found in the foods that we eat. If we're focusing on more of a whole foods diet, then we're going to be able to find fiber-rich diet, whole foods. Like, we're going to be able to find the necessary prebiotics. The gut is going to be able to find necessary prebiotics in those foods. And then introducing probiotics in the form of a supplement, but then also, like, probiotics has just taken on a life of its own, right? There's all of these products that we can have, fermented foods and kefir and kombucha. And I think it's just about finding kind of what fits for your lifestyle and your budget, and paying attention to the importance of having a really varied diet that includes these foods that are considered both in the prebiotic category and the probiotic category. We don't have to take a probiotic supplement, or we don't have to necessarily have access to like bottled beverages. We can be intentional about the foods that we eat that have bacteria, strands of bacteria in them.
So is there anything, like, we're talking about kombucha became all the rage several years ago. And can you have too much kombucha in a day? Or if I put sauerkraut and kimchi on everything, we always say too much of a good thing could be too much. So I'm just curious about prebiotics, probiotics. Can we take too much of them or too many supplements? Because I also am curious, when I look at some of these supplements, it'll say like 300 million whatever's on it. And so what do those numbers even mean?
Yeah. So I think that there are probably millions of strands of bacteria, right? So it's just mm-hmm. a matter of, like, strands of bacteria. Are we possibly lacking in our system, or which ones are going to counter, maybe, right? If we have yeast overgrowth, there's probably a certain direction that we should go in order to counter that. But I always say, like, that your body is always sending you messages about what you're doing and how well it's receiving what you're doing. And I think when we talk about gastrointestinal health, we have to talk about being an observer of our bowels. How often, not only.
Yeah, no, I laughed because it literally, what just popped in my head was when Oprah, I think on one of her episodes, had a GI doctor, and she's like, all right, let's look at the color of our poop.
Yes.
And consistency.
Yes. If you think about it from, like, a functional perspective or an Ayurvedic perspective, it says, like, that our body is sending us messages about, like, its integrity and its health and its functionality all the time. And it's sending us, like, hopefully a daily message in our stool if we take the time to look at it and learn what it means. So when you talk about, can you do too much of kombucha? But your body would be sending you a message, right? Like, you probably would have diarrhea or very loose stool, or there would be a change in your stool if you were overdoing it in some area.
And so I know a lot of people take prebiotic and or probiotic supplements. What do the numbers mean on the bottle? It'll say 100 million. I don't know, whatever it is that's in a probiotic or a prebiotic supplement.
Yeah, so there's supposed to be like live bacteria culture, varying number of live bacteria cultures, and varying, like they're all super long names, right? Like
Yeah.
of the different cultures. Like if you looked at the yogurt package, for example, like it would tell you what's in there, but you probably wouldn't be able to differentiate like the first one from the fifth one on, right? Because of other. So I think probably what's more important to look for is a probiotic that's been demonstrated to survive the gastrointestinal tract and actually get into the gastrointestinal system. So there's a couple of probiotics that they've, their research has been specifically done on, are they able to survive the gastrointestinal tract and then have an actual impact on the gut microbiome? More so than striving for a certain number, I would think. And I also like tested products. I'm often more likely to use a product that's been put up in a randomized control trial and actually tested for efficacy. Or then I might, for my clients, I might recommend a product that I know has been researched and there's been some articles published on it, even if it has a couple thousand million less like live bacteria strands, because I feel like I feel more confident in that product because it's been put up in a trial.
That is really good to, for people to know, to research these things, because when we're at the store looking in the vitamin section and we're looking at numbers, we're always thinking more must be better. But I think like we actually have no clue whether or not what we're putting in our mouths is actually going to survive through the GI system and then get to where it needs to get going.
Yes.
So that's really important information, because I had no idea about that. And there's so many products on the market. So how do you tell the difference between one product or the other? Or some people have trusted brands that they always go to by certain companies. And a lot of times we don't know what we're really putting into our bodies and what effect that they can have, especially when people take antibiotics. And I've heard many stories how antibiotics can really do a number on people's GI systems. And so I think that's important to know too, is if you're taking a certain type of antibiotic, is there a certain type of probiotic that somebody should take to try to counteract some of that destruction that the antibiotic is doing to our microbiome?
Yes. So most people like think at this point, although probably not everybody, is pretty well aware that antibiotics strip our gut microbiome of both the bad bacteria and the good bacteria, right? So occasional antibiotic use that sometimes is necessary, right? But there are implications to our gut microbiome, and we should be intentional about restoring our gut microbiome post antibiotic use. So that's one thing, right? As an adult, you live a relatively healthy lifestyle, you fall ill, you're prescribed an antibiotic, the antibiotic is deemed necessary for what ails you. So you take the course of the antibiotic and then be intentional about trying to rebuild that gut microbiome, right? In the prebiotic foods that you take, and maybe even additionally adding a probiotic supplement. But I think that it's important that we acknowledge that same clinical picture can oftentimes look a whole lot different when we're talking about children, right? Because children sometimes in the very early years of life use antibiotics a lot, right? They have course after course of antibiotics to treat chronic ear infections, right? Or whatever it is that they may, ear infections is oftentimes a lot of what I hear in clinical stories, right? Mm-hmm. Or chronic strep throats, right? So they're constantly getting antibiotics. So that's an important piece of clinical data to have that we wouldn't have always been looking for, because we wouldn't have always been considering the impact of antibiotic use on the gut microbiome and then subsequent biochemical process and neurological activity, right?
Yeah.
So we really do, I think, need to consider that, hey, if we have a young kid who's, again, demonstrating a lot of symptoms, like whether they be ADHD symptoms or behavioral problems, I really wish we could be more curious about what has the health history look like, how much antibiotic use, and could some of this be coming out of a gastrointestinal gut microbiome that's just completely inefficient?
So Are there any emerging therapies or interventions targeting the gut-brain connection for mental health treatment?
A lot of the emerging therapies, I think, maybe are not necessarily specific for the nervous system in the gut, but just for the nervous system in general. So you're seeing a lot of therapies that are focused on like heart rate variability. So the role of heart rate variability in just balanced mood and emotionality overall, right. Vagal tone, right? So the vagus nerve, the polyvagal theory and the role of the vagus nerve. And we're seeing some devices, so digital therapeutics that are coming to market that are focused on like creating more vagal tone or mm-hmm. stimulating the vagus nerve. There is a significant relationship between gastrointestinal health, spinal, like the spinal cord and the vagus nerve. Seeing some interventions and again, wearable digital therapeutics or even different physical touch techniques that are designed to like palpitations of different regions that are designed to stimulate the vagus nerve.
Yeah.
And vagal tone because of the relationship between the vagus nerve, the spinal cord, and the intimate relationship between the spinal cord and the gastrointestinal system.
Yeah. And it's so interesting working with that, that the dorsal vagal and the ventral vagal system, it's like we can be in hypoarousal too. We don't always want to be in the parasympathetic nervous system. It's creating that balance and where we are in the homeostasis of the inner workings of our body. And I do love that you were talking about heart rate variability. And I know that one of the things that you do is heart math biofeedback. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little mm-hmm. bit about that?
Yeah, so HeartMath biofeedback is a form of biofeedback that's focused on improving heart rate variability, right? So improved heart rate variability is associated with cortical facilitation. Mm-hmm. And essentially what that means is harmony or the absence of chaos, if you will, in the relationship between like our brain and our higher visual fields. But so HeartMath Institute has focused on like the role of engaging the heart brain. So all the techniques coming out of HeartMath that are focused on improving heart rate variability are designed to engage the heart brain and to influence the communication between the heart brain and the head brain in order to have a positive impact on our higher visual fields, which essentially is the way we perceive ourselves and any aspect of our human experience, with the goal of trying to perceive more of those aspects of our human experience or ourself in a much more loving, positive, affirming way. So all the techniques coming out of HeartMath are really designed on helping us to engage positive emotionality.
And is there, in terms of the heart math, is there a device or is there some kind of protocol around that?
Yeah, so HeartMath has lots of different devices available. They have devices available that an individual could order on their own and engage with their software or engage with the games that they have available through their software without the assistance of a practitioner. They have, I believe, like an app that works with your phone to practice heart math, to improve heart rate variability. And then they have like tools that are practitioner driven. So they have specific practitioner training for practitioners who want to do heart math in the office. And then there are specific protocols that we use in depending upon what we're wanting to improve, right? So if we're wanting to improve depression or if we're wanting to improve emotion management or we're wanting to work on anxiety or post-traumatic stress disorder, there's just different protocols and essentially just different techniques that we would teach our clients and different periods of time that we would have them engage with the HeartMath software in order to shift heart rhythms to improve or increase heart rate variability, ultimately then to have kind of the positive effects we're looking for in the higher visual fields.
That's amazing. Yeah, I work in the psychedelic space, and I think that's a similar type of outcome that I would want for my clients, this expanded consciousness. And I love that you can get to that place in so many different ways. And I also love the fact that we're talking about, like, we have the obvious brain in our head, right? And then we have the heart brain, and then we have the brain in the stomach.
Yes.
And how they are all connected by the nervous system. And so that's why I love how you're integrating the vagus nerve, what is known as the wandering nerve, right? And how it's just all, we're just, all of this stuff is connected within our nervous system. And of course, we know in hyperarousal, our heart speeds up, right? We feel more anxious. So with the anxiety that we're feeling, things are happening in our brain, like ruminating thoughts, and then also anxiety, like how people report stomach aches. And so it's so interesting to know like how these three major players in our body work together, and how we can work with these three different brains to create more homeostasis within our body, and how that affects really the way that we view the world. Because I know when I'm in a feeling very supported, grounded within myself, I view the world in a completely different way than I view it when I'm either highly anxious, which creates rigidity, right? Or depressed, which is, I can't see anything at that point. So it's just so interesting how all of this works together. And I love that you're doing, I've heard of heart math. I just didn't even really know what it was. And people have brought that in. Oh, have you heard of heart math? I'm doing heart math, because I do have some clients that do have experience heart rate variability, possibly due to some chronic illnesses that they're experiencing. But like, it's just, you know, so interesting that we can do things to help control some of these things, or mitigate maybe some of these things. What advice do you have for listeners looking to improve their mental health through better gut health practices?
Don't discount the impact that the foods that you eat have on your gastrointestinal health, and then subsequently your mental health, right? Going back to that, the earlier part of our conversation where we talked about how, like, we separate the two out. It's like, my mental health needs this and my gut health needs this. That's absolutely not the case, right? There's so much interplay there. Just even knowing that the lion's share of serogenic activity, right, and serotonin receptors are located in the gut, tells you that there's absolutely a relationship between the integrity of gut health and mental health, right? And practitioners like myself who are asking about it, you see it co-occurs all the time, right? It's almost like a given, varying degrees of intensity, right? But it's always going to be there to some degree. So not to discount the role that the food that you eat has both on your gastrointestinal health and your mental health, to establish routines and ways of living that allow for periods of time of non-doing and non-striving. Those can be very soothing to our nervous system, right? And we need that, because with the amount of stimuli that we're taking in, and the amount of stress that we're enduring on a day-to-day basis, and the amount of, like, just the amount that our sympathetic nervous system is firing, right? Those periods of time of non-doing and non-striving are really necessary and can be very restorative to that sophisticated nervous system in our gut. To develop a practice, a feel-good practice, I always say, like, practice positivity. I say that intentionally, because most of the time people say, I'm either positive or I'm not. But I think that we have to learn how to practice positivity, to set aside time to read something on a daily basis, or to engage in some way with some material that speaks to us. There's lots of material out there now, right? Readily available at our hands, right? And all these apps that are available where we're getting positive messages. Because again, if we go back to heart math, heart math's all about connecting with positive feelings, right? All the techniques I teach my clients are about engaging the heart center, right? And applying an emotional shift, right? It's to call to mind, use the mind's eye to call to mind people, places, and things that with very little effort, yes, evoke a strong positive feeling. So it's important, I think, that we take time to practice positivity and cultivate a relationship with positive emotions. So those become more and more familiar to us.
Yeah.
So
go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, by cultivating these positive emotions too, I think just for me personally, when I'm in that space, it creates more space for me to, when I'm deciding what to eat, I can actually like have this conversation with myself. What's going to make me feel the best? I can say, okay, if I eat that sugary piece of cake, I know that in 20 minutes, I am not going to feel physically good. There's a reason why they call these things food hangovers. And so when I'm like, oh, if I choose this bowl that's full of veggies and tofu or whatever, or some type of healthy lean protein, I know what that energy is going to feel like for me, for that I'm going to have energy for the rest of the day. And I'm going to feel, because we're talking about blood sugar spikes too, right? I'm going to feel like I'm on this kind of even keel as opposed to going up and then going down. So I get to just, the more I create more positivity in my life that way, in terms of what you were talking about, we talk about in, I do trauma therapy and we call these things resources, things that we can recall that make us feel good and like really feel good, like in this very grounded way. And we can feel it in the heart, right? Like recalling a kind of memory. It's, oh yeah, when I think about that, that makes my heart leap with joy. And so when I can continue, when I continue those practices, it's going to really shift the way I make decisions about other things in my life as well.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So where can people find you if they want to do more of this integrative mental health work and heart math?
Yeah, you can visit my practice's website, nativeclinics.com. And there's, my profile is on there, and there's a link, a direct link to my email address, nicole.trainer@nativeclinics.com. You can email me. I'd be happy to answer any questions that anybody has after listening to this conversation.
So I have one more question. What inspired you to get into this type of work?
I've always felt like it was a part of my purpose, like of being here, right, on this earth to do mental health work, right? I've always felt called to do mental health work. I think at some point in my training, I just didn't buy in to this idea that people were like mental, if you were mentally ill, like you were mentally ill, right? I just felt like that so much of what I was being taught or trained was to reinforce a subjective experience in my client.
Mm-hmm.
And although those experiences are real for them and they're authentic, I feel like they're largely transient if we learn how to allow them to be, right? And if we learn how to shift our perspectives or to grow in relationship to different mindsets, if you will. So I guess it just sent me out looking for more positive psychology, more health-focused psychology. And then as I tried to enter into those arenas, I got turned on to like integrative mental health was more of a newer term at that point. And then functional medicine is a component of integrated mental health. And I was afforded a couple of really good opportunities, like at Allegheny General Hospital in Pittsburgh. They had a pretty progressive, for its time, like pretty progressive Center for Digestive Health. That was a multidisciplinary team that came together that met with patients, and we developed collaborative or integrative treatment plans. And that sort of informed my work in treating gastrointestinal disorders. So I think a lot of it came out of just feeling, I believe that the default setting is health. And so my classical training didn't necessarily prepare me for that. So I had to go out and find alternative thinkers and alternative theories in order to do the work that I felt passionate about doing. And then ultimately found that a lot of those alternative thinkers and theories exist in more like integrative or complementary alternative medicine kind of modalities.
Yeah. And just remembering that every human is unique and everybody's actual body and their systems are unique. And it's not a one size fits all. So one thing may work for one, something may work for one person that may not work for another person. So I think it's so important to just continue down the path of curiosity of what works for the individual, unique individual in front of you. So I love that you integrate psychology and physiology in your practice.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed our conversation today.
This conversation really reinforced for me the importance of what we put into our bodies and the impact that the types of foods we choose can affect not only our physical health, but our mental health as well. So to learn more about Nicole, you can go to her website, nativeclinics.com. And as always, you can DM me at Mary B. Therapy or visit my website at marybtherapy.com. And thanks for listening.